Good evening and welcome to this special hour-long Friday edition of the KRFP Evening Report for July 6th, 2018. On today's show, we'll bring you the Latah County Human Rights Task Force's Martin Luther King Jr. Annual Breakfast keynote speaker, Nikita Oliver of Seattle. But first, this news. President Donald Trump made a long campaign-style speech in Great Falls, Montana yesterday, targeting U.S. Senator John Tester, who is up for re-election this year. Trump has made the Montana race a priority in his bid to keep the U.S. Senate under Republican control. The president called Tester a liberal Democrat and brought Tester's Republican opponent, State Auditor Matt Rosendale, to the stage where he called him a very special person. Trump personally blames Tester for releasing allegations against his personal physician, Ronnie Jackson, who he had nominated to the top Veterans Administration post in April. The allegations included being drunk on the job, overprescribing medication, and creating a hostile work environment. Jackson withdrew his nomination in April, and Trump said that month Tester will have a big price to pay for releasing the allegations. At Great Falls, Trump said Tester had committed, quote, shameful, dishonest attacks on a great man, a friend of mine. U.S. Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue told farmers in eastern Oregon yesterday his agency is working on, quote, some sort of compensatory mitigation strategy for farmers impacted by President Trump's tariff war with China. He did not elaborate. Speaking after touring Martin Farms in Rufus, Perdue defended the president's decision to impose a 25% tariff on $50 billion worth of Chinese products. China has promised its own tariffs in retaliation, targeting 545 mostly agricultural U.S. products. The Capital Press out of Salem reported Perdue told the farmers President Trump knows they are great patriots. Perdue said he knows that you stand behind him when he calls out China for cheating for years, but he also knows the bank is going to need more than patriotism to pay the bills. Because of the trade war, the price of hard red winter wheat is now $6 per bushel, down from $7. Some of the about 50 farmers who attended the meeting spoke about other issues, including a desire for changes in the National Organic Program requiring organic growers to comply with state and local weed ordinances. They complained the 2,000-acre Azure Farms organic growing operation near Morrow has been letting weeds blow into neighbors' fields. The county tried to intervene last year but was blocked. The contamination issue has worked in the opposite direction in Oregon as well. In 2013, organic farmers and other growers were concerned when a strain of Monsanto experimental genetically modified wheat was found growing in an eastern Oregon field. Foreign countries that import wheat have said they do not want genetically modified wheat or wheat contaminated with GMOs, and growers in the Northwest do not want the contamination as well. Supporters of the Idaho Medicaid Expansion Ballot Initiative plan to deliver thousands of signatures today to Idaho Secretary of State Lawrence Denny. Moscow resident Emily Strizich began the initiative drive with her husband Garrett and family friend Luke Maryville of Sandpoint. They created the group Reclaim Idaho to do so. Co-founder Luke Maryville told the Daily News, "We're getting so little resistance. Everyone we talk to wants to vote for this, no matter where we go." Representatives from Reclaim Idaho traveled throughout the state to gather signatures. Maryville said they will continue to travel the state to promote the initiative throughout the summer. They stopped in Moscow yesterday and spoke to supporters at Gormley Park. The deadline for collecting signatures was May 1st when Reclaim Idaho delivered 56,192 signatures to local county clerks. The clerks' offices have worked to verify the signatures had actually come from registered voters over the last 2 months. Reclaim Idaho says they have met the requirements to get the measure on the November ballot. Under current law in Idaho, it takes signatures from 6% of registered voters in 18 of Idaho's 35 legislative districts to get a measure on the statewide ballot, as well as signatures from 6% of the registered voters statewide. Several years ago, after voters repealed then-Superintendent of Public Instruction Tom Luna's 3 education reform laws with statewide initiatives, the Idaho Farm Bureau Federation pushed for the 18 legislative district requirement, promoting it by saying it would preserve the voice of rural areas if animal rights activists decided to run ballot measure campaigns. Strzic told the Lewiston Tribune, "We have our own internal review process, so we're very confident we meet the requirements. The key message everywhere we're going with is that this is extremely popular. The vast majority of independents and Democrats, as well as 53% of Republicans, say they're willing to vote yes. The intent of the initiative is to expand Medicaid eligibility to include adults younger than 65 who earn less than 133% of the federal poverty line. Organizers expect Medicaid expansion to serve about 60,000 Idaho citizens who fall into the Medicaid gap. The gap population earns too much to qualify for Medicaid, but earns too little to qualify for subsidized health insurance under the state exchange, which falls under the Federal Affordable Care Act." Delegates at the Republican State Convention last weekend passed a resolution opposing the initiative. However, gubernatorial candidates Paulette Jordan supports the initiative, and Republican candidate Brad Little said he will respect the will of the voters if passed. The initiative is still subject to override by the Idaho legislature. Under state law, there is no restriction on the legislature doing so. The Secretary of State now has 15 days to certify the initiative for the November ballot. A wildfire that started in the Snake River Canyon, 12 miles northwest of Clarkston Wednesday, had burned 1,500 acres as of yesterday afternoon. Incident Commander Lonnie Click told the Lewiston Tribune 4 airplanes started dropping water on the fire Wednesday evening, and 2 helicopters are dropping water on the blaze as well. Click said about 75 firefighters were working on the fire, and it was expected to be 30% contained as of last night. He said no structures are threatened. Firefighters near Quincy in central Washington say the Baird Springs fire, which started Tuesday, was 100% contained as of Wednesday afternoon. There have been no injuries or structures destroyed in the large fire. So far, fire officials have not been able to determine the exact number of acres burned. The fire is burning in grass, sage, and wheat fields. Officials closed State Route 28 near Trinidad for a time Tuesday because of the blaze. About 100 firefighters from local fire agencies were on the scene by Tuesday evening. Jeremy Kendall of Wenatchee pled guilty in Chelan County Superior Court Tuesday to setting the Sleepy Hollow fire that destroyed about 30 homes in the Wenatchee area in 2015, which was a record year in terms of square miles burned in Washington. A judge sentenced Kendall to 27 months in prison. Kendall, who is now 39 years old, went to Eastern State Hospital after a court found him unfit to stand trial in 2016. Doctors treated Kendall, and the court found him fit to stand trial, and his arraignment occurred last week. Kendall started the Sleepy Hollow fire in late June 2015. It burned 4 square miles of hillsides outside of Wenatchee. The Sykes Corporation has laid off 640 employees at its call center in Boise. Company spokesperson Dana Wilderman said one of the company's clients had changed their business needs. Wilderman said in an email to the Idaho Press Tribune. Those affected were provided 60 days pay and benefits to provide them time to adjust and seek other employment. We are actively looking to bring new business to our center in Boise and to continue to provide new career opportunities for residents of the Boise metro area. The Moscow City Council will hold its annual budget workshop Monday starting at 8:30 a.m. at City Hall Council Chambers. The budget workshop, which includes presentations of proposed department budgets, may take place over 2 days if necessary. The workshop is scheduled for Monday morning and afternoon with the possibility of reconvening to finish up Tuesday, July 10th at 8:30 a.m. Police arrested Coeur d'Alene entrepreneur Nicholas R. Smoot Wednesday under suspicion of domestic battery. His wife, Kenna, wrote in an email message to the Spokesman Review the incident had been overblown. The email said, "As a strong mother and community advocate against violence, I would never allow myself to stay in an abusive situation. Nick is a huge leader in this community and advocates for better engaged citizens. I can assure you he is not a violent person and would never hurt me. This is a misunderstanding and it will be resolved soon." Smoot has gained attention for his internet activities in northern Idaho since 2014 when he founded Innovation Collective. He has also launched multiple phone applications and partnered to purchase and renovate Coeur d'Alene's Elks Club. Coeur d'Alene police have not yet said what crimes they accuse Smoot of committing. You're tuned into the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman.
KRFP thanks its donors and sponsors, including Hodgins Drug and Hobbies of 307 South Main Street in Moscow. Hodgins features a pharmacy, educational toys, and hobbies. Hodgins also sells and services hearing aids. You can call Hodgins at 208-882-5536.
We now turn to our featured segment. On January 20th, Nikita Oliver of the Seattle People's Party gave the keynote address at the Latah County Human Rights Task Force's Martin Luther King Jr. Annual Breakfast at the Moscow Middle School. Nikita Oliver is an attorney and former candidate for Seattle mayor. She is also an organizer, educator, teacher, and artist. Here's her talk to the several hundred who attended the Latah County Human Rights Task Force's Martin Luther King Jr. Annual Breakfast.
I think it's important to start our spaces with our cultures, with our cultural work and our preservation of who we are. For those of you who don't know, that is the Black National Anthem, Lift Every Voice. I want to start also by acknowledging the elders in the room, acknowledging that it is because of your work and standing on your shoulders that young folks such as myself are able to stand taller and see farther, which means we can make more and even better decisions based on the work that you have done, the human rights that you have pursued, both with the victories and the wins, but also your mistakes. We tend to overlook mistakes, and sometimes, especially when we romanticize people like the Dr. Martin Luther King, we forget that he was human. And in that forgetting his humanity, we actually make it harder for us to continue his work, because guess what? We are still human. And so by knowing the human side of our leaders, those who we follow their vision and their dreams, we are the ones that bring them to fruition, who help manifest them. By acknowledging their humanity, we can also acknowledge our own, but also acknowledge the humanity of those who maybe sometimes feel like they are standing in the way of a better world. I also want to acknowledge that I live in the Coast Salish territories, that Seattle is built upon occupied Duwamish land, that Seattle is named after a Duwamish Suquamish chief, and our seal of our city is Chief Self's face. And we have not done enough, not simply to honor our native and indigenous relatives, but we have not done enough to even make an attempt to repair the harm that has occurred in order to build the United States here on Turtle Island. And to acknowledge that the Reverend was speaking to a nation that has also built itself by using black and brown bodies, the bodies of formerly enslaved black peoples, as capital in order to establish itself. That in the Pacific Northwest, that Chinese people were used to build railroads and not given what they deserved for that work. And as a result, we have built a nation on the theft of labor and life from communities that we still fail to acknowledge. And it's important to keep that understanding, because if we don't, we end up talking about justice in part. And justice in part, in my opinion, is not justice at all. MLK said, as we do this work, if we have not fully achieved justice, then we must remain dissatisfied, that we must continue to do the work. He also said it is work we have to do in love, that hate cannot drive out hate, only love can do that. That dark cannot drive out dark, only light can do that. And sometimes people use that quote in a way to subdue people, to try to get them to be a little less loud. But really, what I think MLK meant with that quote is that love is not the kumbaya moment sometimes. It is not always the sugar-coated moment. Those of you who are parents or caregivers for children know that you love those who you care for, but sometimes you must draw hard lines in the sand. And you do not do that maliciously. In fact, you do that out of love, because you know it is best for them and best for you if you draw that hard line. I believe what MLK was talking about with love was drawing hard lines in the sand and saying, I cannot accept this because this dehumanizes you and this dehumanizes me, and we must do something different. And so because I love you, I will continue to pursue this vigilantly. I believe he talked about light driving out dark because he wanted us to acknowledge what happens when you turn on the lights. Now, I don't know about y'all, but in the morning, if you turn on the lights, it makes my eyes hurt. That is what happens when you have been living in darkness for so long. You turn on the light, and it does come with some pain. But over time, as you allow yourself to live in that light, you begin to adjust. That is love. Sometimes love does come with a little bit of pain in the beginning, not because I want to put pain on you, but because turning on the lights after you've been in a dark room is not something easy to do. I acknowledge in the work that I do that my identity plays a big role in the way that I see the world. That as a black, mixed queer woman from Indianapolis, Indiana, raised by my very fiery, loving mother, who is a white 5'4" woman from Elwood, Indiana, where the mascot is the Black Panther, which is ironic because the KKK likes to be up there. And by my father, even though my parents were not together, who is a 6'2" black man whose history starts in Louisiana, whose father was a sharecropper, my grandfather, whose father not too far behind him can tell you what plantation they were on. And so my history brings a particular sight to the way that I experience and see the world. That's true for all of us. And it's important to acknowledge, because when you are willing to acknowledge your identity, I think of the world in stories. When you acknowledge your identity, you can now acknowledge the role you play in your world and in the role you play in the world that we share. It is from that place that you can then figure out the sort of change that you can contribute to the world to see justice become a reality. But if you are not willing to interrogate your own identity, you may have a hard time figuring out what your place is in this justice work. I've had the pleasure of hearing so many wonderful things about your lovely town. Joanne told me some very exciting stories. I learned about who owns what parts of downtown. I learned about how voting sometimes goes down here. I learned about how when the Aryan Nation was trying to build their church up north, you all saw what was going on and you mobilized your community to say that is the sort of injustice we will not allow to live in our state. Yeah, y'all should applaud for that. I learned about how how when some businesses have said that LGBTQIA people are not welcome there, you all have found ways to create lists of who is an ally, who will say everyone is welcome here, who will truly be about inclusion. And y'all have taken stance that your pride march has gone from 30 people to 200 people. And that is beautiful. These are the sorts of things that help us see justice become more than a conversation and become a reality, become an action, become our willingness to put our bodies, our fortunes, even our families on the line to say, if justice has not come for everyone, then justice has not yet arrived for me either. I have to confess to y'all something. These days I am exceedingly tired. I watched the news this morning, maybe a mistake. Apparently we're shut down. And it becomes very challenging some days to get up and do this work. But it is spending time with folks like yourself and hearing the stories of the work that your community's doing and hearing how y'all get up every day and continue to build a community where you truly believe not just in diversity, but you believe in inclusion. An inclusion that hopefully does not center whiteness as the point of discussion, but centers our humanity, centers the cultural values we all bring to the table, or maybe it's not a table at all. Maybe y'all have decided to do something entirely different. When I think about the legacy of MLK, I usually start first at what I was taught in school. You know what we were taught in school? He had a dream. And he starts that conversation about his dream in that speech by talking about a check that was not yet cashed and reaffirms for us that the Bank of Justice is not bankrupt, so we can cash that check at any time. The question is, do we have the political will and the human will to actually make that happen? Later in his life, it's 1966, Chicago, it's summer, and he is getting ready to deliver an address. And he gets booed. It's one of the few times MLK talks about getting booed. And it was not by white folks or Ku Klux Klanners. It was by young black militant students who had heard about the dream for years at this point and yet had not seen it manifest. And at first, the Reverend Doctor was offended. He thought in his head, well, I have given up so much for y'all. I put my life on the line for this dream. And he goes home that night and he cannot sleep. He lays in his bed and he begins to think about what are all the reasons why these young people would boo him after all the work that he's contributed. And he has to come to realize that he had promised these young folks something that he has not yet been able to help truly manifest. Now fast forward to 2018. And there are a lot of young people who have been told about this dream over and over and over, and maybe even some old folks who still think about it themselves as well. And it makes sense that there are people who are angry, who are tired, who maybe sometimes respond in ways that we are not all comfortable with. Dr. King said, "Sometimes the riot is the voice of the unheard." And we have to grapple with what role, what complicitness have we brought to the table that we have allowed injustice to continue and made it so Dr. King's dream has not yet been realized. What happens to a dream deferred? We all play a role in that, including myself. There's a term that we use in most sociology circles called intersectionality. It was developed by a woman by the name of Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw as she was investigating a case of factory workers where black women were saying, we are being discriminated against, we're not getting hired. And the factory says, well, that's not true, we're not discriminating. We have white women, we have white men, and we have black men. And the black women are like, okay, yes, this is true, but we're being discriminated against specifically because we are black women. And Dr. Crenshaw developed this term to help us think about the ways in which our identities interact with each other, within ourselves, and then interact with the world around us, because she wanted to point us toward a more nuanced, more complex way of thinking about how do we bring about justice. As Audre Lorde said, there is no single issue struggle. Today, women all across our nation are marching. I think some are marching here as well. And they are marching not just for women's rights, but they are marching for human rights, believing that all women, black women, white women, trans women, young women, our elders, all deserve human rights, access to health care, access to the choices about their own reproduction, clean water, places to live, access to jobs and education. And they are using this idea of intersectionality to learn from our mistakes. Last year's Women's March did not include every woman in it the way it should have. And so a year later, we now come back and march again, but with a better understanding of what justice looks like for all women, and are striving to do things different. This is what justice work looks like. We are not going to get it perfect every time. We are humans, and we are working to preserve our humanity. But the most beautiful thing about being human means we have the capacity to learn and do better.
You're listening to Seattle attorney and spoken word artist Nikita Oliver speaking at the Latah County Human Rights Martin Luther King Jr. Day Breakfast Saturday, the 20th of 2018.
And that is part of what I learned from Dr. King's legacy. It's 1968, and he delivers an address about the Poor People's Movement. He understood, after some time of doing this work, that yes, black and brown peoples face oppression in the United States, and it deals with the roots of this country. But also that oppression was created in a way that it dehumanized everybody. And he realized that by uniting, by building strong solidarity relationships with poor white folks and with the labor movement, between black and brown communities and native communities, that we could then build a movement that actually meant there were more of us than there are of the powers that be, and eventually we could make justice come about. Which is essentially why he was assassinated. Because he stumbled upon the key that while our oppression is not the same, our oppressor is the same, and we need to find ways in which we can rise together. That is no easy task. The world that we live in intends to divide and conquer. As long as we remain divided, we will remain ineffective. But we've made a few mistakes about unity. We have treated unity as if it's something that can happen, as if it erases the past, as if it erases history, that we don't have to grapple with it, that we don't have to question it, that we don't have to interrogate it, that we don't have to set it right. But unity actually requires that we be willing to have those hard conversations, the radical conversations that, as Angela Davis said, radical means getting to the root of. That we need to be willing to get to the root of the things in our history that still impact us presently, that make unifying impossible, if we're not willing to say that it is possible, or I'm possible, or we can possibly have this conversation and move forward in a way that honors all of our identities and our struggles, and we can take actions that means we can have unified movements. But that takes work. That takes commitment. And like I told the students yesterday, it is not time-efficient work, but it is relationship and movement-effective work. And you cannot expect people to come to the table and have conversations with you when you have not yet acknowledged the ways in which you've been complicit in their oppression. When you have not yet allowed yourself to sit in spaces where you will listen to what that oppression looks like and how you participate in it. I talked on Thursday night a little bit about resilience. There is a poet that I love. Some of y'all might know him, but I'm gonna guess some of y'all might not. Who knows about Tupac? Woo, I love Moscow. Tupac is a hip-hop artist who was born and raised in Compton, California. His mother was a Black Panther, and he writes a poem about the rose that grew up from the concrete. And in the full version of the poem, he talks about how the rose is often questioned about how did you survive? How did you rise up? How did you come up from the crack in the concrete? But you know what we rarely question? The concrete. And in fact, most of us would like to believe we are the rose. But more of us than we think play roles in keeping the concrete where it is. Even some of us give in to our fragility, whether that's as men, or white people, or wealthy people, and when that rose questions us, we say, but haven't I cracked enough for you? And instead of asking questions like, who mixed that concrete? Who poured that concrete? Who allowed that concrete to dry? Or even asking ourselves, what beauty exists that if that concrete were not there, there would be so much more in the world? And true unity work, true movement work requires us to question the concrete and question ourselves and ask whether or not I am playing a role in that concrete and what role can I play in breaking it up. So I have... ideas for y'all about what it can look like. The first is taking time to reclaim our humanity. There is a system around us and a history that has dehumanized us all. That so long as we allow that to persist, we will have a hard time restoring our balance with each other, and we'll have a hard time restoring our balance with the earth. See, humans have this little idea that we're human supremacists. But guess what? You cannot drink oil and you cannot eat money. And so part of reclaiming our humanity is actually understanding where humanity rests in the big picture of our mother of the earth. Understanding that we are actually a part of a bigger ecological story and that we must learn to follow the lead of those, the first peoples of this land, who know what it is to be caretakers of the land. And for some of us, it is very hard for us to follow anyone. The second thing is, we must, same as we expect justice to be fully intact, we must be dissatisfied with any movement that does not allow anyone else's humanity to be fully intact. I think about communities like our LGBTQIA community that is still struggling to be a part of most movements. Not because they don't want to be, but usually because we don't allow them to be. And if we keep anyone outside of the wall of justice, our humanity will not be fully intact because we have denied someone else the right to be their whole self. This is not new history. In a lot of ways, we are in a loop. So how do we do the loop differently? And thinking about your community, I know that y'all have a very incredible woman who's getting ready to run for governor of your state. I don't know a lot about Paulette Jordan, but what I do know, I deeply appreciate. And it's my understanding she would be the first Native woman to be governor of any state, which is very sad. However, y'all have the opportunity to organize in your communities. Have the opportunity to organize with your families to see Paulette become the first Native governor of any state, but of this state in particular, and to transform what it means to have politics. We've been doing business as usual for a long time, and we've allowed the political structure to be male-dominated, wealth-dominated, and dominated by one religious faith. And folks like Paulette Jordan, simply by her lived experience and the community that she brings to the table, and her campaign, and eventually in her governorship, I'm just gonna claim it, will transform this state and contribute to transforming our nation. The next is, your young people, I had a very impressive conversation with them yesterday. They asked some challenging questions. In fact, one young woman asked me if I could talk about the role of capitalism in education and how that promotes materialism. I was like, wow. This is what your young people in your town are thinking about. I would like you to ask yourselves, what spaces are you creating where they get to vocalize their dreams and vision for the future? An elder by the name of Nikki Giovanni, she's also a poet, said to me this week when I asked her, what does she think young people could be doing more of? She said, I don't think it's my place to tell you because this is the world I gave you. What you choose to do is the vision you must create. And what I'm wondering is, how are y'all supporting these young folks and bringing forth the vision they have? Because clearly they are asking very deep and very relevant questions. The last thing is yourself. MLK said that the greatest obstacle to freedom for Black peoples and brown peoples and Native peoples was not the Ku Klux Klan or the White Citizens Council, but the white moderate who preferred order more than justice. Sometimes we have to enter into a space of chaos in order to allow justice to settle into that space. And that makes us uncomfortable. I invite you to get uncomfortable, to be uncomfortable, experience ideas, peoples, and places, not to go and lead, not to go and tell people what to do, but to hear, to listen, and be made uncomfortable with your own self so you can interrogate what role you play in society. There is an activist by the name of Grace Lee Boggs, God rest her soul, who said, "A revolution that pushes back against those who seek to find ways to divide and rule and pushes towards a movement which honors and transforms ourselves, our communities, and our relationships to each other is what's most necessary." And she grounds the idea of justice and transformation in our relationships. What I find most beautiful about Moscow and what each and every one of you has said, regardless of race, class, or creed, is that there is a community here of relationships that works both with the university and with the local town, and that y'all are consistently finding ways to move. This is your greatest strength. And it is what will lead you all and lead many of us into the next step of what justice looks like. And I'll finish here. Do you mind if I do a poem? Okay. I firmly believe that we are our own greatest medicine. That there is not anything really outside of ourselves that we need, but merely the willingness to dig deep within ourselves to find it. I'm a boxer, and the challenge about boxing is you train for months and months and months, and then you finally get in the ring with an opponent who really wants to beat you up. And the question is, how far down can you dig to find that victory? And so I wrote this poem through my experience as a boxer. When I tell people I'm a boxer, they almost always ask me the same three questions. One, do you get hit? Two, does it ever hurt? Three, but do you ever bleed? And I'm thinking, duh, it's boxing. But my mother raised me right, so I'm polite and I say, yes, I get hit. Sometimes it hurts, and every now and again I bleed. They go, oh! Because see, most people are afraid of blood. Most people are afraid of seeing blood. Most people are most afraid of seeing their own blood, so I tell them this is not the first time I've held my own blood in my hands. Watch the red droplets pool after a string of fighting words smash hard against my face. I'm learning. Boxing and life are really not that much different. My coach keeps telling me, Nikita, you gotta learn to keep your eyes up. But truth is, I still haven't figured out how to keep my head up. So as coach cleans me up, I stare at the carnage, settled into the folds of my flesh, the looking glass of my family tree, and I think, dang, is this all that I'm made of? Nasir Muhammad Ali said, if they can make penicillin out of moldy bread, then they sure can make something out of me. So tell me my blood, my body, what I am made of, so I may know exactly what I can be made into. Spare me no record of wrongs, that I might not become a broken record repeating my family's history time and time again. Let me open every closet in this house, because I am sure there are more closets in this house for me to hide my own skeletons. Tell me about my mother's father, how he liked white sheets in the dark of night, his cross set ablaze and burning in the eyes of little girls who looked no different than me. How he liked his woman silent and empty. Tell me about my mother's mother, how she filled up the silence and the empty, built herself up a broken home around my mama. Show me my mama. Little girl huddled on a tear-drenched floor beneath a roof too holy to shelter her from the downpour of belts and hands. Tell me about my father's father. Tell me a sharecropper's story, a backbreaking work and empty stomach filled to the brim with Negro spirituals. Let me hear my father's mother, my baba, sing our spirituals. She be like, Wade in the water. Just wade in the water, children. Can you hear her singing? How she raised her children up high, above corn and cotton, and taught them to flee before they could be plucked. Let me see the glint of promise in their eyes as their hearts beat hard against rubber, melted down, flexed to once again be plow and ox. Let me feel how cotton, plastic, feel no different in your palms when your bootstraps still refuse to fit this so-called American dream. Please show me just one dream, how black and white have always been the making of a classic movie. Show me the stars in my parents' eyes when they found out they were gonna have this sweet but sick little baby. And my mother, my father, so used to fleeing danger that he cannot figure out how to stay firmly put. Teach me how to stay firmly put. Remind me I am a boxer, I am a fighter, that there is no rot or rust or mold that I cannot transform, that rot and rust and mold have been made into medicine. Remind me I am my own medicine, I am my own medicine, I am my own medicine. So you who also have rot and rust and mold, you too are your own medicine, and together we are the greatest medicine we could ever need. I just want to say one last thing. Please hear me when I say this. I do not blame anyone for the history that you were given, but I do hold us 100% culpable for what we choose to do with it. And I close with that poem because I think it's important to remember and acknowledge that we and our shared story together and the ways in which we choose to tell that story and be a part of it, we are our own medicine. We can also be our own poison. At the end of the day, the choice is 100% ours. Thank you so much.
That was Seattle attorney, organizer, and educator Nikita Oliver giving the keynote address at the annual Latah County Human Rights Task Force's Martin Luther King Jr. annual breakfast held at the Moscow Middle School January 20th of this year. You're tuned in to the KRFP Evening Report, Friday edition. We now turn to our second featured segment with Moscow City Supervisor Gary Riedner explaining a pilot program to adjust sewer rates for certain businesses that use water at the June 25th Moscow City Council Administrative Committee meeting. The Moscow City Council's Administrative Committee directed city staff to move forward with a pilot program to adjust commercial sanitary sewer rates so businesses who irrigate their lawns don't pay as much as businesses who use water to flush cooking fats, oils, and grease into the city sewer system. City Supervisor Gary Riedner explained the pilot program to the committee.
We have, over the past couple of years, had some commercial businesses, small offices typically, that do irrigation in the summer. As you know, and as you know from the fee resolution, our sewer rate studies, and various other documents, that our commercial sewer rate is determined by a base rate that every business pays depending on the loading that their particular business gives. For instance, as I mentioned in the CCSR, if you're a restaurant, because you have fat, oils, and grease as part of the food processing, your sewer rate is a higher rate than, say, a business that does not have that. So there are different classes of sewer rates. You're charged a base rate or a base fee every month for access to the sewer system. Then you're charged increased amounts based on the amount of water you use, assuming that as you use more water, you put more wastewater into the system. So it's rated on 100 cubic foot increments. The confusion comes in when you have water usage that does not go into the sanitary sewer system, so hence irrigation. So we looked at if you've got a business that their actual flow that goes into the sanitary sewer system does not vary quite at all, you know, within limits over the 12-month period, except for the use of irrigation, their water use goes up. then they're being charged for use of the sanitary sewer system, that in fact they are putting no tax on that system. Similar to residences, where you have a water rate and your water rate fluctuates and you pay more based on the volume of water that you use along with a base rate, you're not charged extra for sewer. So no matter how much water you use, if you're a resident, you pay the same sewer rate every month. So we looked at, asked the folks in the utility billing department, engineering, water and sewer departments, to take a look at what circumstances lend themselves more to a residential type application than a straight commercial application. And they've come up with a list of, and in fact, if you guys could come up and sit up here, that would be great. Got Mike Parker from the water department.
Hello.
Meredith Whiteman from water, and we have Cassie Macy, who is our utility billing clerk.
Hi.
So these three, along with Les McDonald, the clerk's director, went through the individual accounts in order to determine which businesses fell more into the residential use category, because their main spike in water use was irrigation. And they've identified about 49 accounts, if my counting is correct. Typically small office businesses that have lawns. Now, and I'll let them Mike kind of take the lead on this, but as their irrigation goes up, they will still be billed for water usage. So as they use more water, they will be billed for that volume rate, but it will not affect the sewer rate. Now, what we've done is we talked about what would be a fair sewer rate to charge these folks. And they get charged right now the base rate, base commercial rate. And then we had to go in and look at 49 accounts that appeared that they fell into that category and determine whether they were using less than 100 cubic feet a month or 100 cubic feet or even above that. And it appeared, if we err on the conservative side, that 200 cubic feet use, which amounts to around $7 a month, appears to be a good compromise. So what we would like to do is we would like to, as a pilot program, develop a separate rate class for those 49 accounts. That will give some relief this year that actually reflects the customer's use of the sanitary sewer system, while these folks continue to analyze sewer usage compared to the water usage. And if there is a better way to do it, then we can develop that and bring that forward over the next year prior to the next irrigation season. So with that, do you folks have anything you'd like to add to that?
No, finding all the outliers to figure out which was the best candidates for this was a challenge, but I think that we thoroughly, between all three of us, worked really hard to go through this list several times and make sure that if this gets approved, that these people do qualify for that within that tier range.
Les, do you have any comments you'd like to make? Okay.
It's a creative solution or creative problem-solving moment here. I'm kind of impressed with it. I think it's a fun idea, and let's see what happens. I like experiments.
Just for Imagineering, can you name anybody who falls into the category?
Well, this all kind of started with a couple, Art. Larry Lucas comes to my mind. His bill was getting a little high, and he questioned it. So we all decided to investigate it. We put a meter in his, a new meter that we could data log and get his usage to figure out how he uses his water to analyze this. Through that, we learned that there is a lot of water that he's paying for. He's paying through irrigation, but it's actually, I mean, it's going on irrigation and not into the sewers. And so I think there was a couple more. JUB was another case that we looked into. The cemetery, there are several others that, you know, just fell into this as we started looking at it more and more, that, you know, we could see that they really put the water onto their lawns. And in speaking with them, they really want a nice place of business. They want it aesthetically pleasing. We tried the conservative aspect to maybe have them go to water conservation and do, some
Wyscaping.
Wyscape, thank you. It was skipping me. Again, the pain meds. I'm not going to dance, though. But we tried conservation as part of this approach as well. Several individuals stated that they really liked the lawn. They liked that atmosphere for their customers to come. So, and by all means, if that's what they want and they're willing to pay for the water, then that's what, you know, they should have.
But. So do we have any preliminary idea of what the impact might be to the sewer fund as an aggregate of 49?
If I can address that, we didn't do an actual dollar for dollar, but it appeared that there were, I believe, about 8 to 10 businesses that had somewhere between 400 to 600 cubic feet per month. There were several businesses that were at 100 cubic feet, and then several in between. So I don't think the amounts, as I indicated, it's about $3.50 per 100 cubic feet. So the impacts are not going to be great. We have about, I believe, 5,600 rate payers out there. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about a very small class.
Yeah.
So,
I just really like the responsive nature of this. I really do. And I'm in favor of it.
Oh,
definitely.
I'm in favor too. I think we should continue with the experiment and see where we wind up, because essentially they're paying for a service they're not receiving, and fair is fair.
Yeah.
Right.
So. Awesome. Yeah. Now, will this come before the whole council?
We'll bring it before the council with the report.
Okay, That's what I want.
When we develop a new rate class, of course, it is, overall it will be, I believe the impact will be less than the full amount if you were to bill it all out separately. So it appears that the fee rate will not violate the fee resolution as it sits now. We'll continue to do that work. But what we're trying to do, again, it's taken a long time to develop this information. We wanted to make sure that we're able to implement it in time for this irrigation season. If necessary, we can make some adjustments, as have been done in the past, mm-hmm. before we get approval through council. But we can make that work.
And that was Moscow City Supervisor Gary Reeder explaining a pilot program to adjust sewer rates for certain businesses that use water in the city at the June 25th Moscow City Council Administrative Committee meeting. Since it's a pilot program, it needed no further approval and was approved by the committee that day. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather. Clear skies Saturday through Wednesday of next week. Highs 76 tomorrow, 84 Sunday, 88 Monday, 79 on Tuesday, and 82 on Wednesday. Lows will be 51 Saturday night, 55 Sunday night, 58 Monday night, and 53 Tuesday night. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. That's KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. I'm Lee Robartis. Dan Granja assisted with tonight's newscast. Have a pleasant evening. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman, community radio for the Palouse at 90.3 on your FM dial, now broadcasting at 1100 watts and online. Have a good night.
KRFP thanks its listeners and sponsors, including Tie-Dye Everything, with locally made tie-dyed items, incense, and other accessories. Tie-Dye Everything is located near 6th Street at 527 South Main Street in Moscow. For more information, you can find Tie-Dye Everything at tiedye-everything.com.
Tune in to Under the Needle, the KEXP Sessions. Hey everybody, I'm Troy Nelson. Join me this week for an infectious live set from the London-based pop troupe, Super Organism. They come to us in support of their debut full-length, Something for Your Mind.
Something for your mind.
It's one-of-a-kind sessions from your favorite artists and from a few you're about to discover. From the studios of KEXP, it's Under the Needle.
Saturday at 3 p.m. on KRFP 90.3.
KRFP is now broadcasting at 1100 watts, bringing progressive media to the greater Palouse.
We made our full power goal a reality thanks to you, our listeners and supporters. The best way we can thank you is to continue our work broadcasting the news, views, commentary, and great music that you depend on when you tune your radio dial to 90.3 FM or listen online.
Our commitment remains strong to sustain the progressive values of Radio Free Moscow for many years to come in this community. Thank you for your support.